This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Futuro.
So I was with two uncles and a cousin, and we were heading down to Miami for vacation.
This is Roland Sylvain, and what he's talking about happened almost 20 years ago.
You know, we're having a good time listening to music.
He's feeling good, sailing down the open road, going about 82 miles an hour, which is more than the speed limit. And as he's cruising through Virginia, a police car pulls up behind him.
I just hear the sirens behind me, so I just pull over. And when I pulled up, I said, oh man, like, I'm going to get in some serious trouble because I don't have my license on me. And all the guys were like, what? What are you talking about? Da, 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 da. And I'm like, I mean, I have my license, but I'm suspended.
From Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, how a little-known change in immigration policy could turn Roland's traffic stop into a life sentence. Roland Sylvain was born in Haiti, though by the time of his birth in 1978, most of his family had one foot out of the country.
My grandfather actually was the one that started it. He had issues in Haiti for political reasons and things like that.
His grandfather's problems started during the brutal dictatorship of President François Duvalier, who's usually known as Papa Doc.
Papa Doc allowed no political dissent. While he ruled, the mortality rate of political prisoners reportedly was the worst in the world.
He and his son, known as Baby Doc, ruled over Haiti from the late 1950s till the mid-1980s.
For the first time in nearly 30 years of Duvalier dictatorships, Haitians are talking openly about overthrowing their leader.
Roland doesn't know exactly what went wrong, but by the time he was born, his grandfather was building a new life for himself in New York City. He was one of tens of thousands of Haitians who came to the U.S. around that time.
Haitians have been fleeing their island, claiming to be refugees from political repression.
Within a few years, Roland's grandfather got settled and was able to bring the rest of his family to New York, legally. And so, in December of 1985, little 7-year-old Roland boarded a plane in shorts and a t-shirt and flew to John F. Kennedy Airport in New York City. And given the time of the year, New York City was a little bit of a shock.
I didn't know there was parts of the world where it was that freezing.
But then a bunch of his relatives pulled up in a really big van.
And they had to run at one of the stores inside the airport and get us coats.
They bundled him up and welcomed Roland to America. From the moment he arrived in the U.S., Roland was a legal permanent resident, and his life became very American very quickly. After a couple of years living in Brooklyn, his parents moved him and his siblings to the New Jersey suburbs. Roland finished high school and got a job at a chemical plant.
Became the manager there. Everybody loved me because I was the youngest guy at the job.
He started making good money. Then after 9/11, he got laid off for a while, which someone else might have seen as a glass half empty kind of situation. But Roland, he saw freedom.
I just had fun. I had my 401k that was loaded, so I took my 401k.
He took off on the road.
Kept going back and forth to Montreal.
Miami, Atlanta.
Well, it was Texas. I did Texas a few times. I was a teenager, so I was just enjoying myself.
And it was on one of these trips that Roland got pulled over for speeding. This traffic stop and the events that followed would lead Roland's story to collide a few years later with another man's, a teenager whose unusual journey through the United States immigration system has derailed tens of thousands of people's lives. We're going to tell you both of their stories, because the trouble Roland got into is still haunting him now. It's threatening almost everything he assumed to be true about his life. And he isn't the only one. Our story today is reported in collaboration with Documented, a local immigration publication here in New York City. Reporters Mazen Sidahmed and Max Siegelbaum teamed up with Latino USA producer Alisa Escarce to follow Roland's story. Mazen Sidahmed is going to pick up the story here.
Roland says his license has been suspended over an unpaid parking ticket about a week before he left for Miami. And he knew he shouldn't have been driving.
But my uncles, they were all like dead tired. So I'm like, okay, fine, I'll take you, I'll drive.
He was driving his uncle's black Mercedes Benz. And at the moment he heard the officer's siren go off, he was driving through Virginia, specifically Hanover County, Virginia, which is pretty conservative and 84% white.
From the time I saw the police officer turn on his lights, I said, oh, yep, you're in this Benz, four black guys. This is the reason why we're getting pulled over.
But of course, he pulled over, the officer asked him to get out of the car, and Roland started panicking.
I'm scared as hell, and then he handed me over the three tickets.
Roland remembers one being for speeding, one for not having his seatbelt on, and one for not having a proper ID. And in that moment, Roland made a split-second decision to sign the tickets using his cousin's name.
So I signed the first two tickets. And when I got to the third ticket to go sign, I just confessed to the officer. I said, dude, I'm so sorry. I just panicked. I lied. My name is Roland.
Roland says the officer turned around and he said,
you just earned yourself three felony charges. And then I just was like, what?
The officer arrested Roland and he was charged with three counts of forgery, one for each signature. Roland was booked into the local jail for a few hours till his family posted bail. Then he was free to go, though he had to go back to Virginia 6 months later to go to court.
And they sentenced me in Virginia for a year and 6 months for each traffic ticket.
Jail time.
Jail time.
That was Latina USA producer Alisa Escarce. Roland couldn't help but wonder if racism was at the root of this whole experience. But of course, he couldn't prove it. And in the end, the jail time was suspended. He just got probation. He didn't spend a day locked up. Roland headed back to New Jersey, started a new job, and life went on as normal. A few years later, he met a girl.
We met through family, of course.
They loved going out to eat and going clubbing. Pretty soon, they fell in love. Then they got married.
We ended up having two beautiful boys.
They bought a house, bought a car.
My life had changed. I wasn't partying as much anymore. I wasn't, you know, hanging out with the boys anymore, with the fellas. I was just settling down.
Even though he was settling down, Roland still had the travel bug. And in the summer of 2011, he booked a trip on a Caribbean cruise with his big extended family. It was the first time he traveled outside the country with all of them.
Being on the ship, my wife and I won like the best couples award because she was pregnant, her stomach's big, and we're just doing all the activities and doing all types of stuff.
On the last day of the cruise, the ship docked in Tampa. The family lined up to go through customs, and Roland pulled out his passport and his green card. And this was the moment when Roland's life as he knew it started to go sideways. You have to remember at this point, Roland had spent the last 26 years living in the U.S. as a legal permanent resident. He really thought of himself as an American, and he had since he was a little kid, so much so that applying for citizenship hadn't crossed his mind. It just never felt like an urgent thing to do. So when the customs officer checked his documents and then pulled him aside, Roland was confused.
And then another officer came and walked us through the bottom of the boat. And I remember asking questions like, what's going on? What's going on?
Roland says the officers took his fingerprints and his green card and told him he'd find out what was going on once he got back to New York.
And when I came back to my family, everyone was crying and going crazy. Like, what's this about? I have no idea.
The family boarded their flight home and they landed in New York a couple of hours later. Roland says an ICE officer met him at the door of the plane and walked into an immigration office inside the airport.
And I remember the lady, the officer there, she said, do you know anything about Virginia? And I said, Virginia? I said, what do you mean? And then she just says, well, this is something that has to do with Virginia. And I was like, what? No way. I started laughing. I'm like, no way. This is impossible. Like, Virginia, that case was done already. Like, I paid my fines. Everything was already finished with.
The woman let Roland go. But a few months later, he had to appear at the immigration court in downtown Manhattan.
I remember the judge at the time, you know, calling everybody's name up. I'm like, wait, what? This is like court for removal.
Like for deportation. Then the judge called up Roland.
All right, we're on the record at the Immigration Court in New York City, January 24th, 2012.
And the judge starts to explain what's going on. So even though Roland was done with Virginia as far as the criminal justice system was concerned, now he was being prosecuted for those same crimes by the Department of Homeland Security.
They're saying on the basis of those criminal cases that you could be removed or deported from the United States. So this is a serious matter. You could lose your resident status and have to leave the country.
I was like, what? It was traffic tickets.
But in Roland's case, traffic tickets were not just traffic tickets. That's because back in 1996, Congress passed a couple of laws that made it so that a wide range of criminal convictions, including things like marijuana possession, and in one case I read about, shoplifting diapers. If you did those things and you were an immigrant, it could trigger mandatory deportation. So ever since then, really small crimes have led to really serious consequences for people who are not citizens. Enforcement of those laws has gotten more and more sophisticated over the years, which probably explains why it took a while for Roland to end up in deportation proceedings after his conviction in Virginia. But when Roland walked off that cruise ship and went through customs, it triggered that enforcement system and it came crashing down on him.
Yes, that's everything I wanted to explain to you. Do you have anything else that you need to ask me at this time?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, good.
The hearing ends, and the judge tells Roland to get a lawyer, which he does. They show up for his next hearing a few months later.
Your Honor, it was a speeding ticket where he used an alias.
That's Roland's lawyer.
He didn't forge the speeding ticket.
No. He forged his last. I mean, he forged someone else's name on the ticket.
It looks like they got three counts out of this, given the way they allege it.
Correct.
The judge says it looks like that conviction for signing his cousin's name on those tickets, it could get him a deportation order. It was after this second hearing that it hit Roland that what he was dealing with wasn't some little administrative issue.
I remember going home and crying. I grabbed Jolin and I was just holding on to Jolin, which is my son.
Immigration cases take a while. And over the next 2 years, Roland had to live with the possibility of being sent back to a country where he doesn't know anyone. He hasn't been to Haiti since he was 7. And the stress of that possibility started to take over his mind.
I couldn't sleep. I was just overthinking everything.
He had chest pains that were so bad he had to go to the doctor. He got really depressed.
It pretty much broke up my family because it put a lot of stress on my wife. I was completely out of it.
Eventually, he and his wife got divorced, and Roland found himself without a place to live.
Walked around with a black bag, with a big black garbage bag. And I would stay at one family member's house. They're like, okay, Roland, well, how long are you going to be staying here? You know, you can't stay here for long. And I'll just pack up a black bag and go to the next family member's house.
But while all of this was happening, Roland's case also started to get some attention. There were articles about him in The Atlantic and a few other places.
And then I'm getting phone calls at like 6 in the morning. Roland, what was going on? Why are you on the news? And da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
At one point, he went down to D.C. with an advocacy group to tell his story to members of Congress.
Each congressman that we met with, you know, the first thing they would say was, anybody want a drink? And I would say, yeah.
He made some friends. He says he even got some letters of support from members of Congress. And on the day of the final hearing,
I remember the judge saying, like, oh, you've got some good people behind you, huh? I see you've made the news. You're pretty popular these days.
Roland was terrified as he waited for the hearing to start.
We're on the record, the Immigration Court, New York City.
But then the judge did something that Roland did not see coming.
So the parties have reached an agreement for administrative closure based on prosecutorial discretion, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
So, sir, your case is going to be administratively closed.
After almost 3 years of going to court over and over again and watching his whole life fall apart, Roland's case was closed.
Now, just briefly, that doesn't mean you win the case. It doesn't mean you lose the case. It means really nothing has happened.
What the judge did here is something called administrative closure, which is basically when judges put a case on pause indefinitely. At the time, judges would do this for a variety of reasons, mostly to keep their caseloads manageable. though the Obama administration sometimes used it as a way to cut people a little slack if they didn't think it was a priority to deport them. It wasn't a foolproof solution. Roland's case could be reopened for really any reason at all. But in that moment, as the case was being closed, Roland just felt relief.
And I was happy afterwards, and I remember going home that night and I cried and cried and cried and cried and cried.
Over the next few years, Roland got a new job and an apartment back in New York City. He started dating a little, and then one day while he was at work, he got an email from his old lawyer
saying that my case has been put back on the calendar.
This was July of 2018, almost 4 years after his case was closed. And what this meant was that Roland had to go back to immigration court. His case was being reopened.
I remember reading this email and shaking, and I ran outside and smoked like 20 cigarettes back to back to back to back to back to back to back nonstop.
And kind of like the first time, it just didn't make sense to him.
I didn't get in trouble. Nothing happened. This must be a mistake.
The email didn't explain what was going on, except for this one clue, a detail.
I think it did mention something about cash flow.
Roland's case was being reopened because of a decision by then Attorney General Jeff Sessions called the Matter of Castro Tomb.
Coming up on Latino USA, we're going to leave Roland Sylvain's story for a moment to track down the mysterious man whose case dragged Roland back into court. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, we're back. And before the break, we met Roland Sylvain, a Haitian-American man who finds himself facing the possibility of deportation a decade after he signed his cousin's name on 3 traffic tickets. Now, Latino USA producer Alisa Escarce is going to take us to Pennsylvania in search of another man, a man Roland has never met, but whose story has altered the course of Roland's life. Alisa has been reporting this story in collaboration with Mazen Sidakhmet and Max Siegelbaum from Documented. And Alisa is going to pick up the story now.
The reason Roland got called back into court was because of this man who the U.S. government lost track of a few years ago when he was a teenager. His name is Reynaldo Castro Tomb.
What we know is he came here when he was 17.
We talked about his case with an immigration lawyer in Philadelphia, a guy named Matthew Archambault. What he knows about Reynaldo comes from government documents.
Unaccompanied minor from Guatemala.
So in June of 2014, this was during the Obama administration, Reynaldo arrived at the U.S. border. He was one of almost 64,000 unaccompanied minors who showed up at the border that year, and the vast majority were from Central America.
It is a huge humanitarian crisis on the border right now. A gigantic, unprecedented surge of minors, most without parents or guardians, crossing our southern border on their own by the thousands.
Reynaldo was picked up by Border Patrol.
He gave the Border Patrol an address.
That address was for his brother-in-law, who lived in a farming town in western Pennsylvania. Reynaldo was planning to live with him while he waited for an immigration judge to consider his case. The government sent him off to Pennsylvania.
The only verification, the only address that they really had was the address that he gave to the Border Patrol.
And that address became important a couple months later, when Reynaldo was supposed to show up in immigration court, because the notice telling him his court date was sent in the mail. Reynaldo was assigned to a court in Philadelphia. But when his hearing date came around in the fall of 2014, he didn't show. So the judge rescheduled the case, but Reynaldo didn't show again. So then this judge, his name is Stephen Morley, he asked the government,
"Can you get me verification that they verified this address and this is the address that he went to?"
Judge Morley was worried that Reynaldo wasn't showing up because he hadn't gotten the letters saying he had to come to court. And after four more hearings, he still wasn't convinced that the government had the right address.
So at some point, Morley got frustrated and said, "Listen, I'm going to close this case. I'm going to put it on my shelf. When you get that verification for me, let me know."
Morley closed the case the same way Roland's judge closed his, by using administrative closure, basically to hit pause till the government got the address thing sorted out. But then the government appealed the case, and this is where things get kind of unusual. That's because the guy in charge of the whole immigration court system at the time, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, he picked out this case and said, "Actually, I'm going to decide this one myself." And his decision would affect way more than just Reynaldo's case. It would change the rules for every other case as well.
To say that, you know, basically judges can't exercise their own independent judgment. So no more administrative closure.
No more administrative closure for anybody. No more putting cases on the shelf. Reynaldo's case got sent back to that judge in Philadelphia, Stephen Morley, and he was told to reschedule the hearing for just a couple weeks later. If Reynaldo didn't show again, the judge was supposed to order him deported, even if he didn't know about the hearing because of that wrong address. And to Matthew Archambault, all of this seemed unfair.
It's like, well, why would you have to pick this case, a kid that's unrepresented? Why not pick many of the thousands of cases where there are attorneys that can actually advocate for their client? So that's what kind of drove me to, like, can we find Casper Tom? And then if not, what are we going to do?
And you were thinking, like, let's find this kid and I'll be his lawyer.
Yeah, and then we can go to court and go, "Hey, here we are." Kind of like screw it all up.
Archambault sent out a message to some other lawyers saying, "Let's go find Reynaldo Kestrotum." And he got connected to a paralegal from a nonprofit who happened to live near Reynaldo's now notorious address. And one afternoon, she set out with a colleague to find him.
So, you know, when you drive down the road, you see some trailer parks, you see a lot of trailer parks.
This is that paralegal, or former paralegal. She's in law school now. Her name is Mana Aliabadi.
You see a lot of churches. I've seen a lot of, like, pro-life billboards or, like, Make America Great Again, that kind of stuff.
Mana drove for about an hour, and she found the address inside one of those trailer parks.
So, yeah, we knocked on the door.
Nobody answered, so she left a note. And a little while later, she got a call.
And it was this guy that said, "Oh, I just got home. I got your note that you left about Reynaldo." So we're like, "Oh, okay, we gotta go back."
She drove back to the address, and she says she was greeted by an older Mexican man
who said, "I just bought this trailer from the previous owner. I don't know this specific person, but I do know that there were a group of five or six workers that were living here, and they were from Central America."
The man didn't know where the previous owners had gone, but he gave Mana another clue.
He said they all, at some point, worked at a specific store in Washington County. So he said, maybe if you go there, they'll have more information.
Mana drove to the store with her colleague. It was a Latino grocery store, and she'd actually met one of the clerks before. So she walked in, found the clerk, and said, "Hey, we were wondering, have you heard of this guy, Reynaldo Castro Tum?"
And she kind of looked at me and didn't say anything. And I said, "Okay." So I think she knows something, but maybe she doesn't want to say it.
The clerk disappeared to the back of the store for a second. And when she came back, she said, "Nope, I don't know that person."
I was like, "Okay, something is going on here."
The clerk seemed to notice that Mana was disappointed and that she wasn't totally convinced.
And she said, "But there's that guy that works here. He's in the back right now. He might know him." And I said, "Oh, okay."
Mana walked to the back of the store.
And this guy is like stocking shelves and we're like, "Hi." And he looks like really worried.
Mana tells him they're looking for Reynaldo and the guy still looks worried. So she tries to reassure him.
"Like, we're not from the government. We just really want to make sure that he shows up to court because it's really important."
Finally, the man says, "No, I don't really know him."
And then he's like, "Okay, hold on a second. I'll be back." And then he went and we were waiting. We were waiting.
They bought something, waited some more. Finally, they gave up and headed back to the car.
And so as we're leaving the store, he's at the side, like smoking a cigarette. And he just looks at us and like looks away. So, yeah, that was kind of it.
"Do you think he was in the back of that store?"
That's Max Siegelbaum, who reported this story with me.
I don't know. I don't think he himself was, but I do think the person we talked to either knew him or was related to him. I'll never be sure.
Mana has spent a lot of time in the communities around Reynaldo's address, and she says that for a lot of people, staying anonymous is a conscious choice.
At a certain point, you know, you kind of got to respect people living in these communities and their wishes to, like, not talk about these things, because usually, even if you do participate or engage with the legal system, it's likely that you won't get the outcome you want.
Back in Philadelphia, Matthew Archambault knew Reynaldo's immigration court hearing was coming up pretty quick. And one day, a couple weeks after the attorney general's decision to reopen Reynaldo's case,
I thought, "Let me dial the 1-800 number to see, like, did they schedule a hearing?" And I dial it, and all of a sudden, I realized that they scheduled a hearing, and it was for the next day. And I thought, "Okay, what can I do?" And I'm like, "Well, I don't have him."
He didn't find Reynaldo, so scratch plan A.
I'm like, "Well, what if I go as a friend of the court?"
A friend of the court. That's when a lawyer can make arguments in a case where they don't have a client. Perfect plan B. So the next day, Archambault walked down to the court. It's just a few blocks from his office. And as he walked into the courtroom, he noticed it was a little busier than usual.
The court is kind of filling up with immigration attorneys who had no business being there other than to watch me.
It seemed like word had gotten around about Archambault's plan.
So Judge Morley walked in.
Remember, he was the judge who had closed Reynaldo's case. Archambault says they've known each other for a long time.
This is a big case for him. And he knows the import of the decision from the attorney general. And he's like, "Oh, Mr. Archambault," he's like, "do you have a client?" And I said, "Not really." So, and he's like, okay, let me sit down.
And the hearing began.
Immigration Judge Stephen Morley presiding the removal proceedings of Reynaldo Castro Tum.
The judge starts the hearing by addressing Archambault.
"Have you been in communication with your client?
You're
a friend of the court clients?"
"We have attempted.
Archambault explains Mana's trip out to the trailer park. And he says he's worried that Reynaldo still doesn't know he's supposed to be here.
And we want to make sure that he gets the fair notice that he is due under the law and comports with a due process." And I could go on. So, but
Archambault's known for joking around in the courtroom.
"I'm sure you could."
It seems like Archambault and Judge Morley agree that Reynaldo getting a deportation order when he probably doesn't even know he needs to be here, that doesn't feel right. But the government lawyer, he's the guy who's prosecuting Reynaldo here, he disagrees.
"I would move to proceed in absentia. I don't believe that there..."
He says that if Reynaldo doesn't show that day, the judge should go ahead and order him deported. No more delays. But Judge Morley thinks giving him one more shot is only fair.
The problem is the address. It's been the problem all along.
So he postpones the case one more time for just a couple months. And he closes by addressing Archambault with a little joke of his own.
And you'll advise your client of the consequences of his failure to appear?
This decision wouldn't be without consequences. After the hearing, Archambault walked up to Judge Morley to get some paperwork.
And he just looked at me and he said, like, I think I'm going to catch some shit for this. And he did. He did. And I think this is where the story becomes more consequential for immigration courts.
A few days later, Matthew Archambault went online to file some paperwork for Reynaldo's next hearing.
And what I noticed is a few days later, Judge Morley was off the case. And it listed Judge Ned Carney.
Judge Dipali Ned Carney.
And Judge Ned Carney, I came to find out, because at headquarters, she's in a judge who works out of headquarters in Virginia.
She was going to travel all the way to Philadelphia to hear Reynaldo's case.
One case. She took the train up, drove up. I don't know how she got here for one case.
So July of 2018 rolled around, the date of Reynaldo's next hearing. And Archambault says the court was also pretty crowded this time. Judge Ned Carney walked in.
This is a removal proceeding being conducted in the matter of Reynaldo Castro Tun.
From the get-go, the tone of this hearing is a little different from the last one. No jokes this time.
Turning to today's hearing, it is now 1:08, and the respondent's still not in the courtroom.
They had called Reynaldo's name in the waiting room, but he's still not here.
The government requested that the court proceed in absentia if the respondent failed to appear today. Mr. Scott, is that the government's position?
Mr. Scott is the government attorney.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then Judge Ned Carney turns to her computer and starts reading her decision.
I find by clear, unequivocal, and convincing evidence that the respondent is removable from the United States, and I will order his removal from the United States to Guatemala.
That's it. Reynaldo Castro Tum is ordered deported.
Is there anything further, Mr. Scott?
Not from DHS.
For most of this hearing, Archambault has been sitting there silently, but he jumps in at the end.
We do want to raise concerns with the manner that this case was handled and the fact that Judge Morley was taken off this matter.
He's like, it really seems like the government was trying to send a message to immigration judges here, that they better be in lockstep with what the attorney general had in mind, or else they could get pulled off their cases.
And as I park, the fact that Attorney General Sessions would choose this case, an unaccompanied minor who's unrepresented, as a seminal case on these issues is quite frankly disturbing and I dare say disgusting. I thank you for coming to Philadelphia.
Okay. Thank you.
And it was, I don't know, I didn't expect anything different.
He figured that at this point, any judge would have ordered Reynaldo deported, even Judge Morley. Since the Attorney General's decision on Castro Tum, there have been a whole series of other decisions that have pushed immigration judges to do exactly what the Trump administration dictates. It's made it harder and harder for them to make independent decisions. They have to toe the line. And this might partly answer this question that I kept thinking about, which was, why Reynaldo Castro Tum? Why this kid who had done nothing wrong, who had broken no laws, and who nobody had had any contact with? And we can't really know, but Archambault seems to think that Sessions kind of picked it out at random.
I mean, he wanted to talk about administrative closure. It's probably just one that they picked out.
But at this point for Archambault, Reynaldo Castro Tum, the man, has become a low-key obsession. Even now, a couple years after the end of the case.
It's funny, every time I have a client from Guatemala, the last thing I ask is, by the way, do you know Reynaldo Castro Tum?
We wanted to hear the judge's perspective on this, and we reached out to the immigration court system to try to talk to Judge Morley and Judge Ned Carney about the case. But we were told that immigration judges don't give interviews.
Good morning.
Come on in.
So I sat down with Ashley Tabador.
It needs to be clear that I'm speaking to you in my capacity as the president of the National Association of Immigration Judges.
Yes.
She is a judge, too, but she's allowed to speak to us as a union representative. And she's not a fan of the Castro-Tum decision for a bunch of reasons, one of which is that now prosecutors and judges can't look at a case and say, you know, it's not a priority to deport this person. Why don't we close their case for now?
So it took out the humanitarian part. It took out the ability for the prosecutor to exercise any compassion or really consider the humanitarian element of the case.
We've heard from lawyers who represent immigrants that a number of their clients who had had cases administratively closed, sometimes for years, have had them reopened.
Well, the cases that have been administratively closed after Castro-Tum are technically now should be reopened.
Which meant that more than 350,000 people could now get sucked back into deportation proceedings. In practice, not all of their cases have been reopened. We don't know exactly how many have, but it's probably in the tens of thousands. And an ICE official recently said at a conference that the government is looking to use the free time they've had during the pandemic to double down on reopening cases. Which gets us back to Roland Sylvain.
Are we doing a test run right now? I guess we're doing a test.
Hey, Roland.
Hi.
The first time Mazen and I talked to Roland was back in January, before the pandemic. So I caught up with him again a few weeks ago. Immigration cases are slow, and not much has happened in his case since it got reopened 2 years ago. But his final hearing is coming up in March of 2021, and the stakes are really high. Without administrative closure, our legal system doesn't have a lot of options for Roland to get to stay in the U.S. But whenever the looming threat of deportation pops into Roland's mind these days, he tries to shut down the thought fast.
Because, you know, the first time around when I dealt with this case, I didn't play the mental trick as much. It literally ate me up.
And he doesn't want to let it eat him up again. Because in the time since his case was reopened, he's built a new, happy life.
You know, I've met the woman of my dreams.
And Roland is in love.
We both had a mutual best friend.
This is Lily, Lillian Henry.
And for like, I would say 2 years, he was hunting me down on social media, liking my pictures.
Lily ignored those likes for a while, but then she noticed a funny coincidence. Roland's birthday is the day before her mother's, which she took as a sign.
So I was like, oh, maybe he is the man. So I sent them a happy birthday on two different social media
sites. Three.
It was two.
It was about four.
It was two.
I wasn't able to fact check the specifics of this.
After she wished me happy birthday on like, I don't know, four or five different.
No.
On like four or five different social media outlets. And I said, okay, she wants me for sure.
When they finally connected, they talked on the phone for 2 days straight, which let them cover a lot of ground.
Like, I love martial arts. He loves that too.
You know, it's all about her daughter and I'm all about my kids.
We really just got along. I felt like he was the mirror image of myself.
During those conversations, Roland told Lily about his immigration case.
And it was one of those things like, gosh, do I stay or do I jump ship? Because that sounds a little complicated and very unfair.
But she didn't jump ship. They actually got married a couple months ago. And his case is part of her life now.
It's like a kryptonite in this house. We don't talk about what if it doesn't work out. We just don't address it. But his mother and I have talked about what if it doesn't work out, what plans we have set up. We've discussed that because, to be fair with you, neither one of us know the country.
Lily was also born in Haiti, and she also immigrated as a young child.
I can't even speak the language fluidly.
Roland can't speak the language fluidly either. And he worries about how people will see him if he does get sent back.
If you're someone that, you know, like they say, you made it to the promised land, you made it to America, and then you ended up being deported back to your country, people usually look at you as being like the
worthless.
Bottom of the barrel, worthless. Like, you know, like, how did you mess that up? What did you do?
He's scared that people are going to look at him and assume that he committed a serious crime.
you know, you're a murderer or you're a robber or a drug dealer or.
They would never understand it's related to traffic
tickets. Right. I mean, even now, even here in America, trying to explain it to like family members or trying to explain it to like, you know, even a few friends and stuff like that, automatically it's like, rolling your line. What did you do?
For now, all Roland can do is try to explain it and wait. There's only a few more months till that final hearing. Roland could find himself back in Haiti soon as a punishment for writing his cousin's name on 3 traffic tickets 2 decades ago. But he's trying not to think about that.
In some parts of the country, the matter of Castro Tum has been ruled unlawful. But not in New York. And now the Trump administration is looking at new rules to eliminate administrative closure everywhere. This episode was produced by Alisa Escarce, Mazen Sidahmed, and Max Siegelbaum. It was reported in partnership with the Wayne Barrett Project at Type Investigations and was edited by Luis Treyes. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Julieta Martinelli, Ginny Montalvo, and Alejandra Salazar, with help from Andrea López Cruzado, Adriana Tapia, and Raúl Pérez. Fact-checking by Hannah Beckler and Mary Retta. Special thanks to Type Investigations editor Sarah Bluestein, as well as Jessica Rofe, Jonathan Greenspan, Dinesh McCoy, Elisa Wellick, Kendall Neistat, Mimi Sankoff, Matthew Lamberti, and Max Mitchell from the Legal Intelligencer in Philadelphia. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. Our director of programming and operations is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Julia Rocha. Our interns are Jimena del Cerro and Emil Sequiros. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. I'll see you there. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Latino USA is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. And the Wincote Foundation.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, Puerto Rican experimental duo Busca Bulla and their return to the island with their album, Regresa. That's next time on Latino USA.